Welcome back, everyone, to another deep dive where we take a look at some interesting sources and try to dig out the most important info. And today we're going a little bit beyond our typical, you know, slip and fall case.
Right.
We're looking at a case where workplace safety and criminal law really kind of collide head on.
Yeah, this is a case that I think will really resonate with a lot of our listeners. You know, it kind of gets at that assumption that a lot of people have that if you're complying with OSHA regulations, then you're kind of in the clear, you know.
You're off the hook.
Yeah, you're off the hook, exactly. And this case, State X Rel, Cornelier v. Black, this was decided by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals back in 1988.
Okay.
And it really throws a wrench in that assumption.
Interesting. So right off the bat, we're already seeing that it's not just about meeting the minimum standards, it seems like.
Right.
There can be some pretty serious legal consequences if something goes wrong.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's why this case is just so fascinating. You know, it raises questions about, you know, when does an accident become negligence? And when does that negligence become criminal?
So let's set the scene a little bit for our listeners.
Okay.
Can you give us some background on this case? Who are the players? What happened?
Sure. So this case revolves around Larry Cornelier, who was an officer at a fireworks manufacturing plant.
Okay, a fireworks factory.
Yeah.
That already sounds kind of risky.
Yeah, it's inherently risky, right? And I think that adds another layer of complexity to this case.
For sure.
So sadly, an employee at the plant, Dennis Witt, he lost his life in an explosion and a fire.
Oh, wow.
At the plant. And after this tragedy, Cornelier was actually charged with homicide by reckless conduct.
Homicide, whoa, okay.
Under Wisconsin law, yeah.
That seems like a really big jump from a typical OSHA violation.
It is. It's definitely a significant escalation. And Cornelier's defense team, they fought hard to get those charges dismissed.
I bet.
You know, they first tried to argue that the complaint against Cornelier lacked probable cause.
Right.
Essentially trying to have the case thrown out right from the beginning.
Nip it in the bud.
Exactly. And when that didn't work, they took a more, I guess you could say, unorthodox approach. They actually petitioned for a writ of habeas corpus.
Now, wait a minute. Habeas corpus, isn't that usually something you see when someone's claiming they're being unlawfully imprisoned?
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's where Wisconsin law gets interesting.
Okay.
See, unlike federal courts, Wisconsin actually allows the use of habeas corpus to challenge the sufficiency of a criminal complaint.
Oh, wow.
Before the trial even begins.
So they're basically saying, hold on, you don't even have enough evidence to charge our client with anything.
Exactly. It was a very clever legal maneuver.
That's interesting. But how did they try to tie habeas corpus into a workplace safety issue?
Well, their argument really hinged on the concept of OSHA preemption.
Okay.
Their claim was that because you have these federal workplace safety laws, specifically OSHA, you know, they already regulate this area, so they should override or preempt state criminal prosecution in this case.
So they're saying OSHA covers it, the feds cover it, Wisconsin, you got to back off.
Exactly. They were arguing that OSHA, with its, you know, fines and penalties, that was the only appropriate avenue to address this tragedy.
So if I'm following this correctly, they're basically saying OSHA already covers workplace safety, so the state of Wisconsin shouldn't be allowed to bring homicide charges.
You got it. That was the essence of their argument.
So did the court buy it?
Not at all. In fact, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, they completely rejected Cornelier's attempt to use OSHA as a shield.
Interesting.
And this is where I think the case gets really interesting, particularly for anyone who works in fields that have, you know, significant federal oversight.
Right.
Because it raises questions about the interplay between state and federal authority.
So the court wasn't swayed by this whole preemption argument.
Right.
But what was their reasoning? How did they justify that decision? Did they explain why OSHA doesn't automatically prevent the state from getting involved in these kinds of cases?
They did. And this is where the case delves into some pretty nuanced legal territory. But to kind of boil it down for our listeners, the court emphasized that while OSHA sets federal standards, you know, those minimum standards, it doesn't eliminate a state's inherent power to protect its own citizens through its own criminal laws.
So it's not an either-or situation.
Right.
It's possible for both federal regulations and state criminal law to apply in a situation like this.
Precisely.
But that still leaves us with the question of, did they actually have enough evidence to charge Cornelier with homicide?
Right.
Did the state have enough evidence to meet that probable cause standard?
That's the million-dollar question, and that's where the specifics of the complaint against Cornelier become crucial.
Okay, so what did the complaint actually say? What did they have on him?
Well, the complaint really painted a pretty damning picture of his actions, or actually more accurately, his inaction.
Okay.
It highlighted his control over the plant's operations.
Right.
the fact that he had been previously convicted for safety violations at a different plant, and perhaps most importantly, there was evidence that he had received specific warnings about the risks at this particular fireworks plant.
He knew.
He knew, but he failed to address them.
So this wasn't just a one-time thing. It sounds like there's a pattern of behavior here.
Yeah, and that's a crucial point. The court seemed to be connecting the dots, you know, looking at the totality of the circumstances.
Yeah.
But here's where it gets really interesting. The court actually focused on Cornelier's omission, his failure to act despite knowing about the dangers.
Wait, so you're saying not doing something can be considered reckless conduct?
That's exactly what the court was saying, and it might seem counterintuitive at first.
It does, a little bit.
But think about it this way. Imagine you see someone drowning, but you just stand there and you choose not to help, even though you're a trained lifeguard. You know, you have the skills and the ability to save that person, but you do nothing.
Right.
That inaction, that choice not to act, that can have really serious legal consequences.
That's a really powerful analogy. I think it highlights that responsibility that comes with certain roles, you know, certain knowledge.
Exactly.
But how does that apply to Cornelier, you know, in the context of this fireworks factory?
Well, the court basically said that Cornelier's position of authority at that plant, his knowledge of those dangerous conditions, and especially his prior convictions for similar safety violations, all of those factors combined, they created a legal duty to act a duty to protect his employees.
So it's not just that he failed to do something. It's that he failed to do something that he was legally obligated to do, you know, given his position and his awareness of the risks.
Precisely. And the court actually cited a really powerful line from a previous case to drive this point home.
Oh, really?
They said, and I quote, "It is just as much an act to deliberately or recklessly refrain from performing a known legal duty as it is to negligently perform that duty."
Wow. That's a pretty strong statement from the court.
Yeah.
It really underscores that idea that inaction can be just as culpable as action under the right circumstances.
Yeah.
But I imagine this whole concept of omission as a criminal act, you know, it can be tricky to apply in practice.
Absolutely. It requires, you know, careful consideration of the specific facts of the case, the individual's role, their knowledge of the potential harm. You know, for our listeners out there in the legal profession, this case really emphasizes the importance of, you know, digging deep into those nuances, really understanding the context.
So it's not always about proving that someone did something wrong, but rather proving that they failed to do what was right. You know, what was legally and morally expected of them in that situation.
Exactly. And that's a crucial distinction, especially when you're dealing with cases involving workplace safety or situations where someone has a clear duty to protect others.
So we've established that the court didn't buy Cornelier's whole OSHA preemption argument, and they found this idea of omission to be a key factor in determining reckless conduct.
Right.
But did they ultimately decide that there was enough evidence, you know, enough probable cause to actually allow the case to move forward?
They did. The Wisconsin Court of Appeals ultimately determined that the complaint against Cornelier did establish probable cause for homicide by reckless conduct. They said, okay, there's enough here to justify a trial.
So what were the key factors that led them to that conclusion? Was it simply the fact that he knew about the safety risks and didn't do enough to address them?
Well, that was a major factor, of course. You know, his knowledge of the dangers and his failure to address them played a significant role. But they also pointed to his prior convictions for similar safety violations at another plant, which, you know, kind of suggests a pattern of behavior, a disregard for safety protocols.
So it seems like they were building a case that, you know, this wasn't just an isolated incident. There's a history here of negligence when it comes to workplace safety.
Right. And that's an important element.
And they also emphasized the fact that Cornelier had control over the plant's operations.
Yeah.
You know, why was that so important?
That's crucial because by highlighting his control, they were essentially saying he wasn't just some, you know, low-level employee who had no power to change things. Mm. He was in a position of authority. He had the power to make changes to implement safety measures, but he chose not to.
So it wasn't just what he knew. It was what he could have done but didn't do.
Exactly.
I feel like this deep dive is really helping us understand how complicated this whole idea of legal responsibility is, you know, especially when it comes to workplace safety.
It is a complex issue.
It's not just black and white. It's very nuanced.
You've hit the nail on the head. And this case really highlights a crucial takeaway for anyone who's involved in workplace safety, whether you're an employer, An employee, a legal professional, simply complying with OSHA regulations isn't a guarantee of immunity
right.
from criminal liability if a tragedy occurs.
It's like that old saying, the law sets the minimum, not the maximum.
Yeah.
You can meet all the technical requirements, you can check all the boxes, but if your actions, or in this case your inactions, demonstrate a reckless disregard for safety, you could still face some serious consequences.
Absolutely. And this case really drives that point home in a very powerful way.
So what would you say is the main message here for our listeners, you know, especially for those who are in positions of authority? What can they learn from Cornelia's experience?
Well, I think the key takeaway here is that a genuine commitment to workplace safety goes beyond simply meeting those minimum standards, you know, set by OSHA or other regulatory bodies. It requires a proactive approach, a willingness to go above and beyond to ensure the well-being of everyone in the workplace.
So it's about creating a culture of safety, not just a culture of compliance.
Exactly.
Because when tragedy strikes, and we know it can happen in any industry, the legal fallout can be a lot more serious than just some OSHA fines.
For sure.
This case shows us that saying, I didn't know, or right. I was just following the rules, that's not going to hold up as a defense if your actions are deemed reckless.
Right. Ignorance is not a shield when it comes to workplace safety. And I think this case serves as a really stark reminder that responsibility and accountability go hand in hand with leadership.
So knowing all of that, I'm curious about this whole concept of reckless conduct. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems a little bit subjective. How do you determine what actually crosses that line? You know, what does it look like in a real workplace setting?
I think it really comes down to a pattern of behavior. You know, it's not always about a single egregious act.
Right.
It's more about, you know, a series of decisions that when you look at them all together, they paint this picture of a conscious disregard for the safety of others.
So it's like the difference between making a genuine mistake
mm-hmm.
versus, you know, deliberately turning a blind eye to a known danger.
Exactly. And I think that's a really important distinction.
So what might that look like in a real world scenario? You know, mm-hmm. can you give our listeners some concrete examples?
Sure. Let's say you're a construction manager and you're under a lot of pressure to meet a deadline, you know, that some of the scaffolding isn't properly secured.
Mm-hmm.
But you decide to push forward anyway, hoping to avoid a delay. Or maybe you're aware that some of your workers haven't received the necessary safety training, but you figure, you know, they'll learn on the job.
Yeah.
These things might seem like, you know, small oversights at the time, especially when you're caught up in the pressures of the job.
Right. You're just trying to get things done.
Exactly. But if one of those decisions leads to an injury or even worse, a fatality, those seemingly minor acts of negligence could be viewed as reckless conduct, you know, in the eyes of the law.
It's a pretty sobering thought. You know, it makes you realize how important it is to not just go through the motions when it comes to safety, but to really understand the responsibility you have. You know, when you've got people's lives in your hands.
Absolutely.
It's easy to get caught up in those deadlines and budgets.
Yeah.
But this case is a powerful reminder that cutting corners on safety can have some really devastating consequences.
Right. And those consequences can go far beyond just, you know, fines or penalties. You could be facing criminal charges.
So this isn't just something for, you know, the folks in the corner office to worry about. It's something that everyone in the workplace needs to be mindful of.
Exactly. If you see something unsafe, you need to speak up. You can't just assume that someone else is going to take care of it. We all have a role to play in creating a culture of safety.
That's such an important point. You know, this case really emphasizes that safety isn't just the responsibility of management. It's a collective responsibility.
Right. It takes everyone working together.
We need to be looking out for each other, you know, being vigilant and speaking up when something doesn't seem right.
And that includes knowing your rights as an employee. You know, if you feel like you're being pressured to work in unsafe conditions or if your concerns about safety are being dismissed, you have every right to report those issues to OSHA or other relevant authorities.
Absolutely. Well, this deep dive has been incredibly insightful. I feel like we've covered so much ground.
Yeah, we've gone from the nuances of habeas corpus and preemption to, you know, this really complex idea of omission as a criminal act.
Right. And we've seen how all of these legal concepts can intersect in a really tragic case like this. You know, a case that highlights those sometimes blurry lines between workplace safety and criminal law.
It's been a fascinating discussion.
I hope our listeners have gained a new perspective on workplace safety and, you know, the very serious legal consequences that can happen when negligence leads to tragedy.
Compliance is crucial, but it's really just the starting point.
Right, it's the bare minimum.
A genuine commitment to safety requires so much more. You know, it requires that proactive mindset, that constant awareness of potential risks, and that willingness to go the extra mile to ensure the well-being of everyone in the workplace.
Well said. This deep dive has been packed with valuable information, and I think there are a lot of important takeaways here for anyone involved in the legal profession or anyone who works in an environment where safety is paramount.
I think it really highlights the fact that the law isn't just about reacting to events. It's also about setting expectations for how we should act and sometimes how we shouldn't act in order to prevent harm.
Absolutely. A huge thank you to our listeners for joining us on this deep dive into state XREL. Cornelier v. Black. It's a case that serves as a powerful reminder that the pursuit of safety is an ongoing process, you know, a shared responsibility that requires our attention and our commitment each and every day. Until next time, stay informed, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay safe.